nor are those considered as acting against nature, who in the married state use their right in the proper manner, although on account of natural reasons, either of time or of certain defects, new life cannot be brought forth. For in matrimony as well as in the use of the matrimonial rights there are also secondary ends, such as mutual aid, the cultivating of mutual love, and the quieting of concupiscence, which husband and wife are not forbidden to consider so long as they are subordinated to the primary end, and so long as the intrinsic nature of the act is preserved. 60. We are deeply touched by the sufferings of those parents who, in extreme want, experience great difficulty in rearing their children. 61. However, they should take care lest the calamitous state of their external affairs should be the occasion for a much more calamitous error. No difficulty can arise that justifies the putting aside of the law of God which forbids all acts intrinsically evil. There is no possible circumstance in which husband and wife cannot, strengthened by the grace of God, fulfill faithfully their duties, and preserve in wedlock their chastity unspotted. This truth of Christian faith is expressed by the teaching of the Council of Trent. Let no one be so rash as to assert that which the fathers of the council have placed under anathema, namely, that there are precepts of God impossible for the just to observe. God does not ask the impossible, but by His commands, instructs you to do what you are able, to pray for what you are not able, that He may help you. 48. 62. This same doctrine was again solemnly repeated and confirmed by the Church in the condemnation of the Jansenist heresy, which dared to utter this blasphemy against the goodness of God. Some precepts of God are, when one considers the powers which man possesses, impossible of fulfillment even to the just who wish to keep the law, and strive to do so, graces lacking whereby these laws could be fulfilled. 49. 63. But another very grave crime is to be noted, venerable brethren, which regards the taking of the life of the offspring hidden in the mother's womb. Some wish it to be allowed and left to the will of the father or the mother. Others say it is unlawful unless there are weighty reasons which they call by the name of medical, social, or eugenic indication, because this matter falls under the penal laws of the state by which the destruction of the offspring begotten but unborn is forbidden. These people demand that the indication, which in one form or another they defend, be recognized as such by the public law, and in no way penalized. There are those, moreover, who ask that the public authorities provide aid for these death-dealing operations, a thing which, sad to say, everyone knows is a very frequent occurrence in some places. 64. As to the medical and therapeutic indication, to which, using their own words, we have made reference, venerable brethren, however much we may pity the mother, whose health and even life is gravely imperiled in the performance of the duty allotted to her by nature, nevertheless, what could ever be a sufficient reason for excusing in any way the direct murder of the innocent? This is precisely what we are dealing with here. Whether inflicted upon the mother or upon the child, it is against the precept of God and the law of nature, "Thou shalt not kill." 50. The life of each is equally sacred, and no one has the power, not even the public authority, to destroy it. It is of no use to appeal to the right of taking away life, for here it is a question of the innocent, whereas that right has regard only to the guilty. Nor is there here question of defense by bloodshed against an unjust aggressor, for who would call an innocent child an unjust aggressor? Again, there is not question here of what is called the law of extreme necessity, which could even extend to the direct killing of the innocent. Upright and skillful doctors strive most praiseworthily to guard and preserve the lives of both mother and child. On the contrary, those show themselves most unworthy of the noble medical profession, who encompass the death of one or the other, through a pretense at practicing medicine, or through motives of misguided pity. 65. All of which agrees with the stern words of the Bishop of Hippo, in denouncing those wicked parents who seek to remain childless, and failing in this, are not ashamed to put their offspring to death. Sometimes this lustful cruelty, or cruel lust, goes so far as to seek to procure a baneful sterility, and if this fails, the fetus conceived in the womb is in one way or another smothered or evacuated, in the desire to destroy the offspring before it has life. Or if it already lives in the womb, to kill it before it is born. If both man and woman are party to such practices, they are not spouses at all, and if from the first they have carried on thus, they have come together not for honest wedlock, but for impure gratification. If both are not party to these deeds, I make bold to say that either the one makes herself a mistress of the husband, or the other simply the paramour of his wife. 51. 66. What is asserted in favor of the social and eugenic indication may and must be accepted, provided lawful and upright methods are employed within the proper limits, but to wish to put forward reasons based upon them for the killing of the innocent is unthinkable and contrary to the divine precept promulgated in the words of the Apostle, "Evil is not to be done that good may come of it." 52. 67. Those who hold the reins of government should not forget that it is the duty of public authority by appropriate laws and sanctions to defend the lives of the innocent, and this all the more so since those whose lives are endangered and assailed cannot defend themselves, among whom we must mention in the first place infants hidden in the mother's womb. And if the public magistrates not only do not defend them, but by their laws and ordinances betray them to death at the hands of doctors or of others, let them remember that God is the judge and avenger of innocent blood which cried from earth to heaven. 53. 68. Finally, that pernicious practice must be condemned which closely touches upon the natural right of men to enter matrimony, but affects also in a real way the welfare of the offspring. For there are some who, over-solicitous for the cause of eugenics, not only give salutary counsel for more certainly procuring the strength and health of the future child, which, indeed, is not contrary to right reason, but put eugenics before aims of a higher order, and by public authority wish to prevent from marrying all those whom, even though naturally fit for marriage, they consider, according to the norms and conjectures of their investigations, would, through hereditary transmission, bring forth defective offspring, and more, they wish to legislate to deprive these of that natural faculty by medical action, despite their unwillingness, and this they do not propose as an infliction of grave punishment under the authority of the state for a crime committed, not to prevent future crimes by guilty persons, but against every right and good they wish the civil authority to arrogate to itself a power over a faculty which it never had and can never legitimately possess. 69. Those who act in this way are at fault in losing sight of the fact that the family is more sacred than the state, and that men are begotten not for the earth and for time, but for heaven and eternity. Although often these individuals are to be dissuaded from entering into matrimony, certainly it is wrong to brand men with the stigma of crime because they contract marriage on the ground that, despite the fact that they are in every respect capable of matrimony, they will give birth only to defective children, even though they use all care and diligence. 70. Public magistrates have no direct power over the bodies of their subjects, therefore, where no crime has taken place, and there is no cause present for grave punishment, they can never directly harm or tamper with the integrity of the body, either for the reasons of eugenics or for any other reason. Saint Thomas teaches this when inquiring whether human judges for the sake of preventing future evils can inflict punishment. He admits that the power indeed exists, as regards certain other forms of evil, but justly and properly denies it as regards the maiming of the body. No one who is guiltless may be punished by a human tribunal, either by flogging to death, or mutilation, or by beating. 54. 71. Furthermore, Christian doctrine establishes, and the light of human reason makes it most clear, that private individuals have no other power over the members of their bodies, and that which pertains to their natural ends, and they are not free to destroy or mutilate their members, or in any other way render themselves unfit for their natural functions, except when no other provision can be made for the good of the whole body. 72. We may now consider another class of errors concerning conjugal faith. Every sin committed as regards the offspring becomes in some way a sin against conjugal faith, since both these blessings are essentially connected. However, we must mention briefly the sources of error and vice corresponding to those virtues which are demanded by conjugal faith, namely the chaste honor existing between man and wife, the due subjection of wife to husband, and the true love which binds both parties together. 73. It follows therefore that they are destroying mutual fidelity, who think that the ideas and morality of our present time concerning a certain harmful and false friendship with a third party can be countenanced, and who teach that a greater freedom of feeling and action in such external relations should be allowed to man and wife, particularly as many so they consider are possessed of an inborn sexual tendency which cannot be satisfied within the narrow limits of monogamous marriage, that rigid attitude which condemns all sensual affections and actions, with a third party they imagine to be a narrowing of mind and heart, something obsolete, or an abject form of jealousy, and, as a result they look upon whatever penal laws are passed by the state, for the preserving of conjugal faith as void, or to be abolished. Such unworthy and idle opinions are condemned by that noble instinct which is found in every chaste husband and wife, and even by the light of the testimony of nature alone, a testimony that is sanctioned and confirmed by the command of God, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." 55, and the words of Christ, "Whosoever shall look on a woman to lust after her hath already committed adultery with her in his heart." 56. The force of this divine precept can never be weakened by any merely human custom, bad example, or pretext of human progress, for just as it is the one and the same, Jesus Christ, yesterday, and today, and the same forever, 57. So it is the one and the same doctrine of Christ that abides, and of which no one jot or tittle shall pass away till law is fulfilled. 58. 74. The same false teachers who try to dim the luster of conjugal faith and purity do not scruple to do away with the honorable and trusting obedience which the woman owes to the man. Many of them even go further, and assert that such a subjection of one party to the other is unworthy of human dignity, that the rights of husband and wife are equal, wherefore, they boldly proclaim the emancipation of women has been, or ought to be effected. This emancipation in their ideas must be threefold, in the ruling of the domestic society, in the administration of family affairs, and in the rearing of the children. It must be social, economic, physiological, that is to say, the woman is to be freed at her own good pleasure from the burdensome duties properly belonging to a wife as companion and mother. We have already said that this is not an emancipation, but a crime, social, inasmuch as the wife being freed from the cares of children and family, should, to the neglect of these, be able to follow her own bent, and devote herself to business, and even public affairs, finally economic. Whereby the woman, even without the knowledge, and against the wish of her husband, may be at liberty to conduct and administer her own affairs, giving her attention chiefly to these rather than to children, husband, and family. 75. This, however, is not the true emancipation of woman, nor that rational and exalted liberty which belongs to the noble office of a Christian woman and wife. It is rather the debasing of the womanly character, and the dignity of motherhood, and indeed of the whole family, as a result of which the husband suffers the loss of his wife, the children of their mother, and the home, and the whole family of an ever-watchful guardian. More than this, this false liberty, and unnatural equality with the husband is to the detriment of the woman herself. For if the woman descends from her truly regal throne, to which she has been raised within the walls of the home by means of the gospel, she will soon be reduced to the old state of slavery, if not in appearance, certainly in reality, and become, as amongst the pagans, the mere instrument of man. 76. This equality of rights, which is so much exaggerated and distorted, must indeed be recognized in those rights which belong to the dignity of the human soul, and which are proper to the marriage contract, and inseparably bound up with wedlock. In such things undoubtedly both parties enjoy the same rights, and are bound by the same obligations. In other things there must be a certain inequality, and due accommodation, which is demanded by the good of the family, and the right ordering and unity and stability of home life. 77. As, however, the social and economic conditions of the married woman must in some way be altered on account of the changes in social intercourse, it is part of the office of the public authority to adapt the civil rights of the wife to modern needs and requirements, keeping in view what the natural disposition and temperament of the female sex, good morality, and the welfare of the family demands, and provided always that the essential order of the domestic society remain intact. Founded as it is on something higher than human authority and wisdom, namely on the authority and wisdom of God, and so not changeable by public laws, or at the pleasure of private individuals. 78. These enemies of marriage go further, however, when they substitute for that true and solid love, which is the basis of conjugal happiness, a certain vague compatibility of temperament. This they call sympathy, and assert that, since it is the only bond by which husband and wife are linked together, when it ceases the marriage is completely dissolved. What else is this than to build a house upon sand? A house that, in the words of Christ, would forthwith be shaken and collapse, as soon as it was exposed to the waves of adversity, and the winds blew, and they beat upon that house, and it fell, and great was the fall thereof. 59. On the other hand, the house built upon a rock, that is to say on mutual conjugal chastity, and strengthened by a deliberate and constant union of spirit, will not only never fall away, but will never be shaken by adversity. 79. We have so far, venerable brethren, shown the excellency of the first two blessings of Christian wedlock which the modern subverters of society are attacking, and now considering that the third blessing, which is that of the sacrament, far surpasses the other two, we should not be surprised to find that this, because of its outstanding excellence, is much more sharply attacked by the same people. They put forward in the first place that matrimony belongs entirely to the profane and purely civil sphere, that it is not to be committed to the religious society, the Church of Christ, but to civil society alone. They then add that the marriage contract is to be freed from any indissoluble bond, and that separation and divorce are not only to be tolerated but sanctioned by the law, from which it follows finally that, robbed of all its holiness, matrimony should be enumerated amongst the secular and civil institutions. The first point is contained in their contention, that the civil act itself should stand for the marriage contract civil matrimony, as it is called, while the religious act is to be considered a mere addition, or at most a concession to a too superstitious people. Moreover, they want it to be no cause for reproach, that marriages be contracted by Catholics, with non-Catholics, without any reference to religion or recourse to the ecclesiastical authorities. The second point, which is but a consequence of the first, is to be found in their excuse for complete divorce, and in their praise and encouragement of those civil laws which favor the loosening of the bond itself, as the salient features of the religious character of all marriage, and particularly of the sacramental marriage of Christians, have been treated at length, and supported by weighty arguments, in the encyclical letters of Leo XLLL. Letters which we have frequently recalled to mind, and expressly made our own, we refer you to them, repeating here only a few points. 80. Even by the light of reason alone, and particularly if the ancient records of history are investigated, if the unwavering popular conscience is interrogated, and the manners and institutions of all races examined, it is sufficiently obvious that there is a certain sacredness and religious character attaching even to the purely natural union of man and woman, not something added by chance, but innate, not imposed by men, but involved in the nature of things, since it has God for its author and has been even from the beginning a foreshadowing of the incarnation of the Word of God. 60. This sacredness of marriage, which is intimately connected with religion, and all that is holy, arises from the divine origin we have just mentioned, from its purpose, which is the begetting and education of children for God, and the binding of man and wife to God through Christian love, and mutual support, and finally it arises from the very nature of wedlock, whose institution is to be sought for in the far-seeing providence of God, whereby it is the means of transmitting life, thus making the parents the ministers, as it were, of the divine omnipotence. To this must be added that new element of dignity which comes from the sacrament, by which the Christian marriage is so ennobled, and raised to such a level, that it appeared to the apostle, as a great sacrament, honorable in every way. 61. 81. This religious character of marriage, its sublime signification of grace, and the union between Christ and the Church, evidently requires that those about to marry should show a holy reverence towards it, and zealously endeavor to make their marriage approach as nearly as possible to the archetype of Christ and the Church. 82. They, therefore, who rashly and heedlessly contract mixed marriages, from which the maternal love and providence of the Church dissuades her children for very sound reasons, fail conspicuously in this respect, sometimes with danger to their eternal salvation. This attitude of the Church to mixed marriages appears in many of her documents, all of which are summed up in the Code of Canon Law, everywhere. And with the greatest strictness the Church forbids marriages between baptized persons, one of whom is a Catholic, and the other a member of a schismatical or heretical sect, and if there is, add to this, the danger of the falling away of the Catholic party, and the perversion of the children, such a marriage is forbidden also by the divine law. 62. If the Church occasionally on account of circumstances does not refuse to grant a dispensation from these strict laws, provided that the divine law remains intact, and the dangers above mentioned are provided against by suitable safeguards, it is unlikely that the Catholic party will not suffer some detriment from such a marriage. 83. Whence it comes about not unfrequently, as experience shows, that deplorable defections from religion occur among the offspring, or at least a headlong descent into that religious indifference which is closely allied to impiety. There is this also to be considered, that in these mixed marriages it becomes much more difficult to imitate by a lively conformity of spirit the mystery of which we have spoken, namely that close union between Christ and His Church. 84. Assuredly, also, will there be wanting that close union of spirit which, as it is the sign and mark of the Church of Christ, so also should be the sign of Christian wedlock, its glory, and adornment. 4. Where there exists diversity of mind, truth, and feeling, the bond of union of mind and heart is wont to be broken, or at least weakened. From this comes the danger lest the love of man and wife grow cold, and the peace and happiness of family life, resting, as it does on the union of hearts, be destroyed. Many centuries ago indeed, the old Roman law had proclaimed, marriages are the union of male and female, a sharing of life, and the communication of divine and human rights. 63. But especially, as we have pointed out, venerable brethren, the daily increasing facility of divorce is an obstacle to the restoration of marriage to that state of perfection which the divine Redeemer willed it should possess. 85. The advocates of the neo-paganism of today have learned nothing from the sad state of affairs, but instead, day by day, more and more vehemently, they continue by legislation to attack the indissolubility of the marriage bond, proclaiming that the lawfulness of divorce must be recognized, and that the antiquated laws should give place to a new and more humane legislation. Many and varied are the grounds put forward for divorce, some arising from the wickedness and the guilt of the persons concerned, others arising from the circumstances of the case, the former they describe as subjective, the latter as objective. In a word, whatever might make married life hard or unpleasant, they strive to prove their contentions regarding these grounds for the divorce legislation they would bring about, by various arguments. Thus, in the first place, they maintain that it is for the good of either party, that the one who is innocent should have the right to separate from the guilty, or that the guilty should be withdrawn from a union which is unpleasing to him, and against his will. In the second place, they argue, the good of the child demands this, for either it will be deprived of a proper education, or the natural fruits of it, and will too easily be affected by the discords and shortcomings of the parents, and drawn from the path of virtue. And thirdly, the common good of society requires that these marriages should be completely dissolved, which are now incapable of producing their natural results, and that legal reparations should be allowed when crimes are to be feared, as the result of the common habitation and intercourse of the parties. This last, they say, must be admitted to avoid the crimes being committed purposely with a view to obtaining the desired sentence of divorce for which the judge can legally loose the marriage bond, as also to prevent people from coming before the courts, when it is obvious from the state of the case that they are in, and perjuring themselves, all of which brings the court and the lawful authority into contempt. Hence the civil laws, in their opinion, have to be reformed to meet these new requirements, to suit the changes of the times, and the changes in men's opinions, civil institutions, and customs. Each of these reasons is considered by them as conclusive, so that all taken together offer a clear proof of the necessity of granting divorce in certain cases. 86. Others, taking a step further, simply state that marriage, being a private contract, is, like other private contracts, to be left to the consent and good pleasure of both parties, and so can be dissolved for any reason whatsoever. 87. Opposed to all these reckless opinions, venerable brethren, stands the unalterable law of God, fully confirmed by Christ, a law, that can never be deprived of its force by the decrees of men, the ideas of a people, or the will of any legislator. What God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. 64. And if any man, acting contrary to this law, shall have put asunder, his action is null and void, and the consequence remains, as Christ himself has explicitly confirmed, every one that putteth away his wife, and marrieth another, committeth adultery, and he, that marrieth her, that is put away from her husband, committeth adultery. 65. Moreover, these words refer to every kind of marriage, even that which is natural and legitimate only, for, as has already been observed, that indissolubility by which the loosening of the bond is once and for all removed from the whim of the parties, and from every secular power, is a property of every true marriage. 88. Let that solemn pronouncement of the Council of Trent be recalled to mind in which, under the stigma of anathema, it condemned these errors. If any one should say that on account of heresy, or the hardships of cohabitation, or a deliberate abuse of one party by the other the marriage tie may be loosened, let him be anathema. 66. And again, if any one should say that the churches, in having taught, or in teaching that, according to the teaching of the gospel, and the apostles, the bond of marriage cannot be loosed, because of the sin of adultery of either party, or that neither party, even though he be innocent, having given no cause for the sin of adultery, can contract another marriage during the lifetime of the other, and that he commits adultery, who marries another after putting away his adulterous wife, and likewise that she commits adultery, who puts away her husband, and marries another, let him be anathema. 67. 89. If therefore the church has not erred, and does not err in teaching this, and consequently it is certain that the bond of marriage cannot be loosed even on account of the sin of adultery, it is evident that all the other weaker excuses that can be, and are usually brought forward, are of no value whatsoever, and the objections brought against the firmness of the marriage bond are easily answered, for, in certain circumstances, imperfect separation of the parties is allowed, the bond not being severed. This separation, which the Church herself permits and expressly mentions in her canon law, in those canons which deal with the separation of the parties, as to marital relationship and cohabitation, removes all the alleged inconveniences and dangers. 68. It will be for the sacred law, and, to some extent, also the civil law, in so far as civil matters are affected, to lay down the grounds, the conditions, the method, and precautions to be taken in a case of this kind in order to safeguard the education of the children, and the well-being of the family, and to remove all those evils which threaten the married persons, the children, and the state. Now all those arguments that are brought forward to prove the indissolubility of the marriage tie, arguments which have already been touched upon, can equally be applied to excluding not only the necessity of divorce, but even the power to grant it, while for all the advantages that can be put forward for the former, there can be adduced as many disadvantages and evils which are a formidable menace to the whole of human society. 90. To revert again to the expression of our predecessor, it is hardly necessary to point out what an amount of good is involved in the absolute indissolubility of wedlock, and what a train of evils follows upon divorce. Whenever the marriage bond remains intact, then we find marriage is contracted with a sense of safety and security, while, when separations are considered, and the dangers of divorce are present, the marriage contract itself becomes insecure, or at least gives ground for anxiety and surprises. On the one hand, we see a wonderful strengthening of goodwill and cooperation in the daily life of husband and wife, while, on the other, Both of these are miserably weakened by the presence of a facility for divorce. Here we have at a very opportune moment a source of help by which both parties are enabled to preserve their purity and loyalty. There we find harmful inducements to unfaithfulness. On this side we find the birth of children, and their tuition and upbringing effectively promoted, many avenues of discord closed amongst families and relations, and the beginnings of rivalry and jealousy easily suppressed. On that, very great obstacles to the birth and rearing of children, and their education, and many occasions of quarrels, and seeds of jealousy sown everywhere. Finally, but especially, the dignity and position of women in civil and domestic society is reinstated by the former, while by the latter it is shamefully lowered, and the danger is incurred of their being considered outcasts, slaves of the lust of men. 69. 91. To conclude with the important words of Leo XIII, since the destruction of family life and the loss of national wealth is brought about more by the corruption of morals than by anything else, it is easily seen that divorce, which is born of the perverted morals of a people, and leads, as experiment shows, to vicious habits in public and private life, is particularly opposed to the well-being of the family and of the state. The serious nature of these evils will be the more clearly recognized when we remember that, once divorce has been allowed, there will be no sufficient means of keeping it in check within any definite bounds. Great is the force of example, greater still that of lust, and with such incitements it cannot but happen that divorce and its consequent setting loose of the passions should spread daily and attack the souls of many like a contagious disease or a river bursting its banks and flooding the land. 70. 92. Thus, as we read in the same letter, unless things change, the human family and state have every reason to fear lest they should suffer absolute ruin. 71. All this was written 50 years ago. Yet it is confirmed by the daily increasing corruption of morals and the unheard-of degradation of the family in those lands where communism reigns unchecked. 93. Thus far, venerable brethren, we have admired with due reverence what the all-wise Creator and Redeemer of the human race has ordained with regard to human marriage. At the same time we have expressed our grief that such a pious ordinance of the divine goodness should today, and on every side, be frustrated and trampled upon by the passions, errors, and vices of men. 94. It is then fitting that, with all fatherly solicitude, we should turn our mind to seek out suitable remedies, whereby those most detestable abuses which we have mentioned may be removed, and everywhere marriage may again be revealed. To this end, it behoves us, above all else, to call to mind that firmly established principle, esteemed alike in sound philosophy and sacred theology, namely, that whatever things have deviated from their right order, cannot he brought back to that original state which is in harmony with their nature except by a return to the divine plan which, as the angelic doctor teaches, 72, is the exemplar of all right order. 95. Wherefore, our predecessor of happy memory, Leo XLLL, attacked the doctrine of the naturalists in these words: it is a divinely appointed law that whatsoever things are constituted by God, the author of nature, these we find the more useful and salutary, the more they remain in their natural state, unimpaired and unchanged. Inasmuch as God, the Creator of all things, intimately knows what is suited to the constitution and the preservation of each, and by his will and mind has so ordained all this that each may duly achieve its purpose. But if the boldness and wickedness of men change, and disturb this order of things, so providentially disposed, then, indeed, things so wonderfully ordained will begin to be injurious, or will cease to be beneficial. either, because, in the change, they have lost their power to benefit, or because God Himself is thus pleased to draw down chastisement on the pride and presumption of men. 73. 96. In order, therefore, to restore due order in this matter of marriage, it is necessary that all should bear in mind what is the divine plan, and strive to conform to it. 97. Wherefore, since the chief obstacle to this study is the power of unbridled lust, which indeed is the most potent cause of sinning against the sacred laws of matrimony, and since man cannot hold in check his passions unless he first subject himself to God, this must be his primary endeavor, in accordance with the plan divinely ordained. For it is a sacred ordinance that whoever shall have first subjected himself to God will, by the aid of divine grace, be glad to subject to himself his own passions and concupiscence, while he, who is a rebel against God will, to his sorrow, experience within himself the violent rebellion of his worst passions. 98. And how wisely this has been decreed, Saint Augustine Ursios: this indeed is fitting, that the lower be subject to the higher, so that he, who would have subject to himself whatever is below him, should himself submit to whatever is above him. Acknowledge order, seek peace, be thou subject to God, and thy flesh subject to thee. What more fitting, what more fair? Thou art subject to the higher, and the lower is subject to thee. Do thou serve him who made thee, so that that which was made for thee may serve thee. For we do not commend this order, namely, the flesh to thee, and thou to God, but thou to God, and the flesh to thee. If, however, thou despisest the subjection of thyself to God, thou shalt never bring about the subjection of the flesh to thyself. If thou dost not obey the Lord, thou shalt be tormented by thy servant. 74. This right ordering on the part of God's wisdom is mentioned by the holy doctor of the Gentiles, inspired by the Holy Ghost, for in speaking of those ancient philosophers who refused to adore and reverence him whom they knew to be the creator of the universe, he says, "Wherefore God gave them up to the desires of their heart, unto uncleanness, to dishonor their own bodies among themselves," and again, "For the same God delivered them up to shameful affections." 75. And Saint James says, "God resisteth the proud and giveth grace to the humble." 76. Without which grace, as the same doctor of the Gentiles reminds us, man cannot subdue the rebellion of his flesh. 77. 99. Consequently, as the onslaughts of these uncontrolled passions cannot in any way be lessened, unless the spirit first shows a humble compliance of duty and reverence towards its Maker, it is above all and before all needful that those who are joined in the bond of sacred wedlock should be wholly imbued with a profound and genuine sense of duty towards God, which will shape their whole lives, and fill their minds and wills with a very deep reverence for the majesty of God. 100. Quite fittingly, therefore, and quite in accordance with the defined norm of Christian sentiment, do those pastors of souls act who, to prevent married people from failing in the observance of God's law, urge them to perform their duty and exercise their religion so that they should give themselves to God, continually ask for His divine assistance, frequent the sacraments, and always nourish and preserve a loyal and thoroughly sincere devotion to God. 101. They are greatly deceived who, having underestimated or neglected these means which rise above nature, think that they can induce men by the use and discovery of the natural sciences, such as those of biology, the science of heredity, and the like, to curb their carnal desires. We do not say this in order to belittle those natural means which are not dishonest, for God is the author of nature as well as of grace, and he has disposed the good things of both orders for the beneficial use of men. The faithful, therefore, can, and ought to be assisted also by natural means. But they are mistaken who think that these means are able to establish chastity in the nuptial union, or that they are more effective than supernatural grace. 102. This conformity of wedlock and moral conduct with the divine laws respective of marriage, without which its effective restoration cannot be brought about, supposes, however, that all can discern readily, with real certainty, and without any accompanying error, what those laws are. But every one can see to how many fallacies an avenue would be opened up and how many errors would become mixed with the truth, if it were left solely to the light of reason of each to find it out, or if it were to be discovered by the private interpretation of the truth which is revealed. And if this is applicable to many other truths of the moral order, we must all the more pay attention to those things which appertain to marriage, where the inordinate desire for pleasure can attack frail human nature, and easily deceive it, and lead it astray. This is all the more true of the observance of the divine law, which demands sometimes hard and repeated sacrifices, for which, as experience points out, a weak man can find so many excuses for avoiding the fulfillment of the divine law. 103. On this account, in order that no falsification or corruption of the divine law, but a true genuine knowledge of it may enlighten the minds of men, and guide their conduct, it is necessary that a filial and humble obedience towards the Church should be combined with devotedness to God, and the desire of submitting to Him. For Christ Himself made the Church the teacher of truth in those things also which concern the right regulation of moral conduct, even though some knowledge of the same is not beyond human reason. For just as God, in the case of the natural truths of religion and morals, added revelation to the light of reason, so that what is right and true, in the present state also of the human race may be known readily with real certainty, without any admixture of error, 78. So for the same purpose He has constituted the Church the guardian and the teacher of the whole of the truth concerning religion and moral conduct. To her therefore should the faithful show obedience and subject their minds and hearts so as to be kept unharmed and free from error and moral corruption, and so that they shall not deprive themselves of that assistance given by God with such liberal bounty. They ought to show this due obedience not only when the Church defines something with solemn judgment, but also, in proper proportion, when by the constitutions and decrees of the Holy See, opinions are prescribed and condemned as dangerous or distorted. 79. 104. Wherefore, let the faithful also be on their guard against the overrated independence of private judgment, and that false autonomy of human reason, for it is quite foreign to every one bearing the name of a Christian, to trust his own mental powers with such pride, as to agree only with those things which he can examine from their inner nature, and to imagine that the Church, sent by God to teach and guide all nations, is not conversant with present affairs and circumstances, or even that they must obey only in those matters which she has decreed by solemn definition, as though her other decisions might be presumed to be false, or putting forward insufficient motive for truth and honesty. Quite to the contrary, a characteristic of all true followers of Christ, lettered or unlettered, is to suffer themselves to be guided and led in all things that touch upon faith or morals by the Holy Church of God, through its supreme pastor the Roman Pontiff, who is himself guided by Jesus Christ our Lord. 105. Consequently, since everything must be referred to the law and mind of God, in order to bring about the universal and permanent restoration of marriage, it is indeed of the utmost importance that the faithful should be well instructed concerning matrimony, both by word of mouth and by the written word, not cursorily, but often and fully, by means of plain and weighty arguments, so that these truths will strike the intellect and will be deeply engraved on their hearts. Let them realize and diligently reflect upon the great wisdom, kindness, and bounty God has shown towards the human race, not only by the institution of marriage, but also, and quite as much, by upholding it with sacred laws, still more, in wonderfully raising it to the dignity of a sacrament, by which such an abundant fountain of graces has been opened to those joined in Christian wedlock, that these may be able to serve the noble purposes of wedlock for their own welfare, and for that of their children, of the community, and also for that of human relationship. 106. Certainly, if the latter-day subverters of marriage are entirely devoted to misleading the minds of men, and corrupting their hearts, to making a mockery of matrimonial purity, and extolling the filthiest of vices by means of books and pamphlets, and other innumerable methods, much more ought you, venerable brethren, whom the Holy Ghost has placed as bishops, to rule the Church of God, which He hath purchased with His own blood, 80, to give yourselves wholly to this, that through yourselves and through the priests subject to you, and, moreover, through the laity welded together by Catholic action, so much desired and recommended by us, into a power of hierarchical apostolate, you may, by every fitting means, oppose error by truth, vice by the excellent dignity of chastity, the slavery of covetousness by the liberty of the sons of God, 81, that disastrous ease, in obtaining divorce by an enduring love in the bond of marriage, and by the inviolate pledge of fidelity given even to death. 107. Thus will it come to pass that the faithful will wholeheartedly thank God that they are bound together by His command, and led by gentle compulsion, to fly as far as possible from every kind of idolatry of the flesh, and from the base slavery of the passions. They will, in a great measure, turn and be turned away from these abominable opinions which to the dishonor of man's dignity are now spread about in speech, and in writing, and collected under the title of perfect marriage, and which indeed would make that perfect marriage nothing better than depraved marriage, as it has been rightly and truly called. 108. Such wholesome instruction and religious training in regard to Christian marriage will be quite different from that exaggerated physiological education by means of which, in these times of ours, some reformers of married life make pretense of helping those joined in wedlock, laying much stress on these physiological matters, in which is learned rather the art of sinning in a subtle way, and the virtue of living chastely. 109. So, venerable brethren, we make entirely our own the words which our predecessor of happy memory, Leo XLLL, in his encyclical letter on Christian marriage addressed to the bishops of the whole world: take care not to spare your efforts and authority in bringing about that among the people committed to your guidance that doctrine may be preserved whole and unadulterated which Christ the Lord, and the apostles, the interpreters of the divine will, have handed down, and which the Catholic Church herself has religiously preserved, and commanded to be observed by the faithful of every age. 82. 110. Even the very best instruction given by the Church, however, will not alone suffice to bring about once more conformity of marriage to the law of God. Something more is needed in addition to the education of the mind, namely a steadfast determination of the will, on the part of husband and wife, to observe the sacred laws of God, and of nature in regard to marriage. In fine, in spite of what others may wish to assert and spread abroad by word of mouth, or in writing, let husband and wife resolve to stand fast to the commandments of God, in all things, that matrimony demands, always to render to each other the assistance of mutual love, to preserve the honor of chastity, not to lay profane hands on the stable nature of the bond, to use the rights given them by marriage, in a way that will be always Christian and sacred, more especially in the first years of wedlock, so that should there be need of continency afterwards, custom will have made it easier for each to preserve it,